In 2020, Matthew Ritter was unanimously elected to be Connecticut's 105th Speaker of the House, nearly three decades after his father, Thomas Ritter, held the same position. But the Connecticut of 2021 is a much different state than it was then, with benefits like an increasing rainy day fund, as well as the ongoing challenges of the pandemic. And it seems that the land of steady habits is at a pivotal point for growth and equity. We'd like to welcome Speaker of the House Matt Ritter to the Municipal Voice today as we discuss the 2021 legislative session. We'd like to thank our premier sponsor at Digital Back Office, Palo Alto Networks. Check them out at digitalbackoffice.com or paloaltonetworks.com. The Municipal Voice is the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities podcast in collaboration with WNHH LP 103.5 FM. I'm your host, Matt Ford. As always, be sure to give us a like and let us know what you're thinking in the comments. CCM's Municipal Voice podcast continues to present a key forum on important state-local issues. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the consensus views of CCM or our member municipal leaders. Mr. Speaker, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Also sitting in, we have Brian O'Connor, our Director of Public Policy and Advocacy at CCM, to provide some expertise. So let's get right into it.
He most certainly does.
He does. Oh, he knows you. Quite a few things. So last year, before you were Speaker, the short legislative session was cut even shorter by the pandemic. A majority of items that were going to be considered were either saved for a special session towards the end of the year or pushed to this year. What has it been like to try to get so much accomplished, to have so much on the table all at once?
You know, every session is probably similar. You feel like just wave after wave of things is coming through. Clearly, because of COVID, things either were old bills that didn't get a chance to go, or just new ideas and new concepts that have come up, right? Things that have just changed our lives. I think of telehealth that came out of nowhere and now sort of part of our everyday, you know, lives. You know, my view is that at the end of the day, we will find time to manage the things that we need to manage and prioritize. But it does put a premium on working across the aisle and with the upper chamber and the governor's office, because we don't have time to do every bill if it's going to take 12 hours. So in some ways, the more that you have, the more it encourages cooperation and bipartisanship on bills, because people know they have to find a willingness to, you know, to get there with folks. The downside, of course, is that you probably have some later nights than you want to, and maybe some more session days than you want to. So there's a balance. There's probably good and bad to both. Yeah.
It adds some pressure. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, Mr. Speaker, how does that change how you handle, you know, working with your chairs, you know, as far as, you know, making those priorities and setting those priorities?
Yeah. I mean, what you say to people is, look, we will go through the process of sitting down with our chairs, reviewing the amendments and saying, look, can we live with this amendment? I think so. And we put much more emphasis on reviewing the potential compromise that exists out there. We put a lot more pressure on my friends on the other side of the aisle to give us something, right? And we have found on many bills that we're voting on that we've been able to find some decent compromises. But then there are just some issues like no excuse absentee balloting or early voting where there was just no amendment, there was no compromise possible. We want that to be the exception, not the rule. And I think we've done a pretty good job with that so far.
Excellent. So we're obviously still kind of in the middle of this pandemic. We see the light at the end of the tunnel. There's some good signs. But so far, even as some institutions have started opening up, the legislative office building is staying closed.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is important? And do you feel like it's even harder trying to work doing everything remotely?
Yeah, I mean, look, I wish we could open the building up, and I think we all miss the hustle and bustle. I'm in my office sometimes alone, and it's kind of frightening and different, right? But the problem is we will have some people who are still not fully vaccinated, even who have gotten shots, probably for another couple of weeks, which is not abnormal. We've had cases of COVID, even in the legislature, in the last 10 days. Mm-hmm. So we just can't risk the session being derailed when we have a constitutional adjournment date of June 9th. So I feel that pressure, I feel that tug, but I think at the end of the day, we'll be open next year. We are doing everything on Zoom. People still have emails and cell phone numbers and work numbers people can call. And yeah, it's not perfect, but we lost one session. I think to lose another with so much at stake, including the biennium budget, is a risk we just can't take.
So there's an old saying that when everything is important, nothing is important. You had the benefit of a long session this year, but how do you choose priorities amongst everything? What's most important for your caucus and most important for the state?
So for the caucus anyway, you kind of get a sense, right? So part of it is you have to have your own as leadership. Hopefully if you've gotten to the point where you're a speaker, a majority leader, or a chair of committee, you've gotten there because you have the values of the majority of your caucus and you spot issues or pick up on issues that people like and enjoy that you're running with. So I think naturally, as you move up, hopefully you have that pulse. And so that's where your bills come from. You talk to people, you have like-minded ideas. What I think is hard is not so much the big bills, right? Like there's 10 big bills that I think you kind of knew we were going to do this year. It's harder is that middle pool, which can be just as impactful, right? Or just as powerful. And those are really hard to pick sometimes because you might have your caucus split on it. You might have a disagreement with the governor's office or the Senate. And so the thing we really try to do is over-communicate. We really try to go out of our way to make sure the right people are in the room who need to make these things happen. Minority party, majority party, and the right folks. It's harder with a pandemic and harder on Zoom than when you could just walk across the hall. Mm-hmm. But I think we try to triage and pick our bills based upon feedback and again, getting direction from all the people who are in the room. We have a really robust screening process. There's like 20 people in screening, and Brian's aware of this, and it may seem cumbersome, it may seem old school, but you get a lot of different viewpoints when you have screening reflected of members who are moderate, liberal, from urban areas, suburban areas, rural areas. You get a pretty good cross-section of the caucus.
And I was going to say, with the pandemic, have you found it's actually easier in a certain way of getting people to prioritize or focus, let's say, on social equity, economic development, education?
Yeah, I think people knew coming in the situation we faced. And I think the biggest fear was that we never knew at what point we'd be looking at a 14-day shutdown. So think about it. If you're going to work on your bills and you never know how it's going to work, and then for a while the House and Senate weren't in on the same day, right? When that's in the back of your mind as a chair, you automatically have to reduce the amount of things you're going to try to do, I think. No question about it.
Really?
Remember, when we started session, the vaccines were just rolling out. There was concern about the strains, the efficacy. I think we look at it now and we feel pretty confident. But back in January and February, when bills get proposed, we didn't know, whether it was going to work at 60% level or 90%. Turns out the latter, which is great news for the state and for our country.
Yeah. Looking at the pandemic there, in an op-ed in The Current, you said that Connecticut needs to take care of those left behind this pandemic. How are we going to do that? What role does a state play and what role do municipalities play in making sure that those things happen?
Yeah, I mean, I start with the nurses and the long-term care health workers right now who are hopefully not going to be on strike in 2 days. But if you think about the workers who dealt with the most, they're right at the top of the list. And unlike their peers in the medical industry, doctors and so forth, they don't get paid at the same level. Mm-hmm. And so for folks like that, when you think about who got left behind, that's why I've been so public and outspoken about the need to make sure we give those raises to those workers. We talk about, looking at folks who also during the pandemic have been relying heavily on federal assistance. If it weren't for the stimulus checks, if it weren't for the unemployment that the federal government extended, we'd have a lot of people in dire straits, even more so than they are today. So we're looking at expanding the earned income tax credit here in Connecticut back to 30% where it was 9 years ago to help address that. We've already done minimum wage phased in, so folks get another increase this year. Trying to put more money in people's pockets who are working, right, who are seeking to employ themselves and provide for their families. We need a budget that, gets as well into healthcare and making sure that the exchange is robust. The federal government has subsidized our exchange here in Connecticut to the tune of $84 million, mm-hmm. greatly making it so much easier for our middle-class families to not only go on the exchange, but buy a good product. So mm-hmm. we want to make sure that, if that federal money continues, that's great, but that's another policy that we're thinking about. How do we continue to prop up our exchange so that it's a marketplace that actually works for our citizens around healthcare? And all those things came to light, because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. A lot's been talked about equity, an equity fund, if you will. I think we'll hopefully have an announcement in the coming days about maybe a middle path about how to address that mm-hmm. that doesn't do an end around the spending cap, but does still provide the same or close to the same level of funding in a different way. But I think when we pass a budget, my goal is this. The federal money is really game changing, and the governor did a really good deal, really good proposal, what he came up with. We'll have some tweaks about, free summer camp this summer, free daycare for a while, investing in tourism, housing. We can do so much with that funding for the next 2 years, but it's also beyond those 2 years, right? We got to make sure that years 3 and 4, we can continue to address those things. So a good budget will be on time. It'll be reasonable in its spending commitments. It will stay within the spending cap, but also set us up in year 3 and 4 with things that are bold and big And I think we'll have more news in the coming days on that.
Great. Brian, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, actually, I just want to have a follow-up on that. I know many municipal leaders, I think one of their concerns is what happens in year 3 and 4.
Yep.
If a lot of this one-time revenue or federal revenue was put in place, how do you, you know, how are you going to make it so there's not a structural fall in revenue?
I mean, so it's a great question, because if you look at the governor's plan and probably what we'll come up with, right, we are not modeling our budget by using the federal monies for ongoing expenditures. They really are one or two time in nature, carried over a couple of years. And that, I mean, that is, I can't say every dollar will be to that extent, but most of it, I'd say 90% of it right now, is proposed to not be going to ongoing expenditures. So we shouldn't have that cliff. You know, the reality is we had fiscal losses because of the pandemic the last couple of years. Our revenue was better than we thought. We still have a $1.6 billion deficit in large part due to COVID. But my hope is that we've had almost 35,000 people move into the state of Connecticut. I would imagine that this summer and this fall will be about as good for the economy as it's been since the early 1980s in terms of growth, right? That's not my numbers, that's the Fed numbers. I don't see why the state of Connecticut doesn't enter this biennium and then the biennium after that in pretty good financial condition, with decent, you know, with stable revenues, if anything, probably more revenues. We've expended within a spending cap, so you know you're not going well above that number. And we still have a $3.2 billion rainy day fund. We're still appropriating $1 billion almost early to prepay pensions. We're putting so much into pensions that we're going to save almost $100 million in the biennium of next year on the ARC for our pensions. And we're really doing good stuff. So I think although there is concern about that cliff, Brian, it's a fair question. We're sticking with the deposit in the pension fund early. We're not taking that money and building it into our budget, right? We're not raiding the rainy day fund. We're doing all the responsible things to set us up well. What's missing from that, though, is to make sure that while you're being fiscally prudent, you aren't ignoring the realities that we need a lot more money for brownfield cleanup, a lot more money for low interest loans in our city, a lot more money for streetscapes. We need more money for our libraries in our urban areas and our distressed areas. We need to find a consistent revenue stream that provides comfort to our urban and poorer areas of the state, which are not all urban, they're rural too, in Eastern Connecticut and other places, that we're going to make sure we have funds available for you to build up economic development, take care of dilapidated properties, and help your residents. And I think there's a way to do that. And again, I think we'll have something in the next couple of days, which is pretty exciting.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I know everybody's on the – it's just on
we're excited about that.
I know. Everybody's. I'll just say that the proposals to date have relied on sort of going around the spending cap for equity. And although I agree with the ultimate goal, I just don't know that that's the right way to do it. But I will say that John Rowland worked in the legislature – Jody Rell worked with the legislature, both on very big, bold initiatives, one to renovate UConn, the other to renovate our board of our higher education institutions. Both were deemed expensive at the time and turned out to be worth every single penny. So maybe that's a model we should try to follow.
most of the executive orders that were put out were set to expire on May 19th. And, you know, municipal leaders were wondering how the state was going to proceed. And I know you've been working on that just very recently. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on there going forward?
So we're going to vote tonight, actually, on it. Okay. We've revamped the statute by special act. So first thing we found out when we all got in a room, Republicans and Democrats, was the first goal was to rewrite the underlying statutes in response to the Supreme Court case, the Connecticut Supreme Court case. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, that's tough. Everyone throughout, you know, the public health emergency versus civil preparedness, right? Public health is actually sometimes easier to draft because the expectation is that the public health emergency would be, you know, something like an ongoing process. It gets a little trickier when it's short term. So people say, for example, the legislature should vote to authorize these emergencies. I actually don't disagree with that, except if there's a tornado or a 48-inch snowstorm like in 1979. I can't get the legislature to vote the next day. So we started realizing that we're probably going to have a different standard for different incidents and different emergencies. So we're actually going to create a commission, really a blue ribbon type commission this summer to give us recommendations to amend the underlying statutes going forward. In the short term, we'll have a special act that will govern us through March just related to COVID. Mm-hmm. And the way that's going to work is the governor can still ask for emergency power, but the legislature will have to approve it. That committee of 10 will go away. It's got to be done by the House and Senate. And we're even going to have veto power for the legislative leaders. So of the six leaders, if four of us vote to veto an EO, then it would be vetoed. That was actually a Len Fasano amendment from last year, as I joked with Kevin Kelly. Len's amendment wasn't ready then, it's ready now. And we're actually gonna run it, we're gonna run it tonight. It just wasn't ready last year. But I think what's changed is vaccinations. I think last year there was so much unknown that you really felt nervous in this pandemic. And remember where we were in March and April. I mean, the idea that, you know, we needed the governor just to move and respond, and everything was changing daily. We weren't wearing masks at the beginning. So the idea of boxing this up into a legislative process, I think, was very concerning for Democratic leaders and public health officials and hospitals and nursing staffs and things like that. I think fast forward a year later, what's changed is that we have a pretty good handle because of vaccines. And we're more confident that the governor's EOs will be less draconian in nature. The scope won't be as broad. It'll be much more narrow. And so if there's a disagreement, it's probably on policy, but it wouldn't jeopardize the public health. I think that's the distinction today from a year ago.
Are you going to have a look-in provision? Let's say you gave him the governor, him or her, the authority over 6 months, that you could look in and say, you know, after 60 days, I don't think we need that anymore. Would the leadership have veto power at that point?
You know, I think our veto power is at the beginning, not in the middle, like a look-in, Brian. It's a good question. But I remind people, if it was really egregious, which, by the way, I don't think the governor will do that, we can always call ourselves in a special session. And my view is that if four leaders agree that a particular executive order was way out of bounds, you then know you'd have the votes to call yourselves in and override a gubernatorial veto if it came to that.
Excellent. So getting to some specifics for this year that are important to us, I think, payments in lieu of taxes, or PILOT, is a crucial piece of funding that is going through some changes. For one, the program is going to be tiered to distribute the funds in a more equitable manner. But towns and cities aren't counting on the dollars until they receive them, because for years, PILOT has been underfunded. How do you square more equitable funding without fully funding the program?
So in my 11 years, there's been a lot of iterations on PILOT and car tax, and Brian was heavily involved in that stuff as well. And Speaker Sharkey really deserves a lot of credit for getting that ball rolling on those conversations. And Jeff Berger and John Von Fair and others who were in finance at the time. Here's my view. In February, we did something bizarre, right? People go, oh, they can't do this. We put a new PILOT formula in. We put new money in. People said, well, they haven't done the budget. But that was a marker. I think that was Marty and I saying, and Jason and Bob saying, you know, PILOT's going to be an important part of responding to this, because you want to talk about equity, you want to talk about fairness. If the cities are constantly raising their mill rate and constantly raising taxes, you are raising taxes on the, in some cases, the poorest zip codes in New England. And there's nothing more regressive than the property tax, right? So I think we feel that moment. So I think you're going to see us stick very firmly on the PILOT funding and want to make that work. You know, then the other thing that happened is the feds wrote some pretty big checks to municipalities. So look, they're going to be okay for a couple of years, but long term, we have to make that commitment. I think the difference with the formula that we came up with this time is we didn't take away from anybody. You know, one of the problems in the past is it wasn't new money. It was sort of reallocating funds, and that creates internal dynamics in your caucus that are not pleasant. But I think that the money we added, which is about $120 million, I think we have room in the general fund to pay half of it. We should bond the rest. The bonding, which is very similar to what we do with steep grants, will make sure that we're not crowding out other appropriations. I think it makes it far more likely the revenue stream will be predictable in the future than it's subject to appropriation and spending cap restrictions. You know, the governor and I, you know, work very well together. The one thing that I've pushed him on, particularly with lower interest rates, is we can borrow a little more money. I think that the numbers we were coming in were too low. Because although the debt diet might have been an attractive statement, bonding is a great mechanism by which to spur economic development and provide money like PILOT and programs like that without, you know, going through issues in the spending cap. And so there's more room to do that, and I'd recommend that you do that. Because I think every dollar you do that, yes, the state pays interest, but you are helping your cities grow and prosper, which hopefully means you're bringing in more businesses, more people who want to live there, and alleviating and lifting people out of poverty. That's a worthwhile investment, in my opinion.
Yeah, Brian, what are you hearing from our members on this?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think, you know, one of the things that we're looking for, and it sounds like this is very complementary to it, is investment in our downtowns, cleaning up brownfields, as you mentioned earlier. I think those are the kind of investments that local leaders are looking at.
Yeah, and you know, the problem now is that we do a lot of this stuff, right? So, I mean, I've gotten grants for Hartford, and we've done brownfields, but it doesn't always seem strategic. So the bond commission on one day will say, congratulations, Naugatuck. We're going to clean up a brownfield for you. And then a year later, we clean up a brownfield in this town. Or we have a pot of brownfield money of $10 million and that goes to it. But it's subject annually to another debate and a sense of which direction does the governor or the legislature want to go in. So if you're going to talk about true investment in these types of economic development projects, it should be a 10 or 12 year plan where you can look back and say, we're going to clean up 425 brownfield sites. We're going to renovate 32 libraries. We are going to, you know, change and rehabilitate 52 urban area parks and playgrounds per year. We should be better about making broader scale investments over 10 or 12 years than what I call the 1 year bond commission effect. Every 12 months, it's a new book. It's not even a new chapter. I want us to think about a 10 or 12 year plan that really gives people and investors an opportunity to say, they're doing some stuff different, right? They're looking differently as opposed to this year over year or governor after governor.
Onto a slightly different topic, the effort to legalize marijuana in Connecticut has seen a lot of attention this year, more so obviously since New York and New Jersey have legalized. About two-thirds of Connecticut residents at this point are supporting legalization. One House bill aims to pair legalization efforts with equity measures. Can you tell us about that, and what are some of the speed bumps involved with that issue?
We're working on it. Jason Rojas, the majority leader, has been phenomenal, really sort of leading our leadership efforts to try to get there and meet with folks. So I'm optimistic we'll get there. It's a tricky issue. And, you know, people mm-hmm. view marijuana maybe in the public as sort of the legislature, you know, as, you know, the Democrats are for, the Republicans are against. It's very mixed. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, it's an issue that I get very different responses from people than I expect. It's mm-hmm. very personal to some people. So it makes vote counting very different. You know, I know there's this feeling that all I got to do is go in a room and yell and scream and we'll win the football game. Not on something like this. This is so personal that you really have to let people evaluate the bill when it's finally drafted. So that's why it's slower than most bills that leadership's in favor of. Do I think it will happen eventually? I do. A, the public is behind it. B, our neighboring states are doing it. But I look, as a father, as someone who coaches a youth baseball team, I get it. I mean, I don't want kids exposed to drugs and alcohol at a young age and getting addicted either. I mean, I worry about vaping. I worry about smoking. I mean, I worry about all that stuff. Where my mind has always been set on, though, is access. It is so readily accessible. Now it's even more readily accessible in neighboring states where you can buy it legally, that at some point, I don't really know what our laws are doing other than continuing sort of this notion that it's a crime and arresting people, not for small possession, but in some cases, people getting arrested. And also encouraging the black market where the drugs have become more powerful and, you know, the THC levels are far higher than we want. I'd rather us take it in, test it like the medicinal marijuana program, make sure it's safe. The revenue means nothing. People roll their eyes at me. I don't know how much revenue we're going to bring in. If it's legal in every state around us, I'm not even sure the revenue you'll have. And the medicinal marijuana program is still not taxed. And we have 40,000 users in that. So it's not a big revenue grab. It's a matter of just, it's the reality of 2021 in America and New England.
You are listening to the Municipal Voice on WNHH 103.5 FM.
So one reform that CCM is supporting is the bottle bill, which would double the deposit on recyclable containers from 5 cents to 10 cents and possibly expand some kinds of containers that can be returned into, you know, water bottles and some stuff like that. You called it one of your top environmental priorities for 2021. What are the benefits?
I am the perfect example of why the bottle bill is necessary. Mm-hmm. Okay. My wife has to constantly stop me from throwing things into the recycling bin. She has to remind me what is eligible. Right. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that after I drank my Sam Summer in a bottle and I threw the bottle in the blue bin, that I was doing the right thing. Well, turns out not always, right? Glass has become the enemy of our single stream recycling.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reality is that we just have a system that doesn't work anymore. And we need to get people to return bottles mm-hmm. back to redemption centers. Right. And we need to get redemption centers more profitable. To make this whole equation work. And the other problem is the more that we have, you know, the glass in the single stream, the less, mm-hmm. you know, towns are getting, the higher their tipping fees are. So there's a lot of reasons to do it. Now, I also didn't realize what a complicated issue this is. I mean, I suppose I realized it, but I've really immersed myself in it. I've had a lot of meetings on it, probably as much as any other issue that I've dealt with in terms of, because there's so many parties. And we'll see where it gets. I mean, I just think at the end of the day, though, something has to give. So I'm with CCM and the municipalities on this. We have to figure out, and we need a long-term play for our trash. Yeah. You know, the Mira plant is not going to be there. And right now, the only option we have is to take trash and truck it somewhere, and that's not a long-term solution. So, you know, every speaker gets a lovely, lovely, you know, gift in their term or terms, whatever they get, whatever they're lucky enough to get about the issues they have to face. It looks like I'll be dealing with trash and mine. I think it's a burgeoning crisis, and I don't mean to use that word too often. I don't use that word too often. It's a real major problem for our town. So
yeah, definitely.
I think we'll be talking about it for years to come.
Yeah, yeah, changes in China has affected all this, Brian. Yeah,
I was just going to say, I think there's probably market opportunities as well, you know, once someone tries to figure this out and finds a reuse for the bottles.
Yeah, it doesn't just have to be a cost. It could actually be profitable for somebody if they figure out the right.
That's right. And I've heard of all kinds of innovations around, like, glass can be used in roads, and they're doing that in our state. Mm-hmm. So, like, there are things out there. They're just a few years away, and we need a bridge or something. But it's a tricky issue, because everybody has everyone has their own favorite in the game, if you will. And I've met with them all, and I've heard all their viewpoints. We'll see what happens. But it's something, at some point, we got to do something better for our state. You know, we've been a leader in environmental causes like that for a long time, and I think we've kind of slid off a little bit.
Agreed. Brian, is there any other topics that you wanted to talk about today?
Yeah, you know, one that I know our local leaders have been vocalizing more and more to our office and to I know their individual legislators, but the being able to continue to hold hybrid meetings or virtual meetings. I think there's a fear of what happens on May 20th. And I think long-term, they're looking to have it be permissive in nature so that you don't have to have it for every single local meeting, but at least have that ability. Is there any movement to attack that problem over the next couple of weeks before the 19th happens?
You know, I just talked to the majority leader about it today and his chief of staff, and we're working on it. I think the permissive model is better. I think there was a mandate in some other bills, which I think went a little too far. But I think that the permissive nature of it with the right safeguards makes a lot of sense. And, you know, just as a, you know, you think about it, if you're on the town council in a big city or whatever, you know, you kind of sign up for the job. But there's a lot of other boards and commissions, quite frankly, that it's hard to find people willing to do it. And I'm not saying that they're going to be on remote the whole time, but the ability to once in a while go remote and participate, I think you'll actually bring more talented people and more energetic people into the fold, especially folks who may, you know, say, look, I'll do it, but I got my kid's game, or I got to travel for this particular meeting. So I'll be at 8 of the 12 meetings. Well, in the old world, if you're only going to make 8 of the 12 council meetings, they probably would tell you not to come, right? Or it'd be a bad look. If you can do it remotely from traveling, whatever, I think you'll get more, again, you'll get more involvement and more engaged. People want to step up and say, you know, I can make that work if I can do a couple meetings here and there remotely. So that's why I like it, is you get better people volunteering for these boards and commissions that often get overlooked because of the time commitment.
Believe it or not, Mr. Speaker, we had this conversation last night with our Little League board in the town of Portland, where some people are like, I don't know if I want to go in person at 8 o'clock at night. I kind of like these remote meetings.
You know, as a lawyer, right, in my other life, I go to meetings all the time at night. And I will tell you, I have sometimes a drive at 7 o'clock. I get there for 7 o'clock. I don't even get called till 8:30, and I get home at 10:30. Now, no one feels bad for the lawyer who gets home at 10:30. But if you're a town, I would tell the lawyer, why don't you call in when we're ready for it? I mean, there's a lot of changes it can make just to how we run meetings more efficiently and more effectively. I think it's here to stay. So I would never want to be in the way of that modernization of meetings. You just want to make sure the public has the right to still go in person if they want to. You hope that towns will take seriously that the Zoom option should be maybe for inclement weather or when people really are truly sick or out of town. And you don't want government, I think, run full-time that way, but it should be a good option for people or good alternative every once in a while. I think that's a fair way to phrase it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, Speaker Ritter, thanks so much for talking with us today. I know you got to go meet with the governor.
Matt, I appreciate it. Brian, as always, good questions, and we'll see you all soon. Thanks again for having me.
We'd like to thank our guests, Speaker of the House, Matt Ritter. I'd like to thank our premier sponsors, Digital Back Office, Palo Alto Networks, which you can check out at digitalbackoffice.com and paloaltonetworks.com. The Municipal Voice is a co-production by CCM and WNHH 103.5 FM. Kevin Malone is our executive producer. Christopher Gilson is our producer. Harry draws on the board. And I'm Matt Ford, your host. Be sure to check out our Facebook page and give us a like. And watch out for our CCM chat series on our YouTube page.